it would be fairly large. It's $183 million a year is what it would be authorized at.
Question that some policymakers are advancing is the idea of forcing students to take 15 credit hours to essentially, that would be the new full-time.
This is In the Know with ACCT, the voice of community college leaders. I'm Jacob Bray. I'm here with
India Rogers. I'm the board and communications associate for ACCT.
Ji-Hang Lee, vice president for public policy and external relations with ACCT.
Jennifer Stittard, ACCT director of government relations.
And today we are talking about the Higher Education Act. The Higher Education Act was signed into law in 1965 and was intended to strengthen the federal government's commitment to higher education. The act has been reauthorized 8 times, most recently in 2008. Late last year, the House of Representatives released a draft of the Promoting Real Opportunity, Success, and Prosperity Through Education Reform, or PROSPER Act. The bill passed out of committee on a party line vote and may be considered by the full House this year.
So, as Jacob mentioned, the original Higher Education Act was signed into law in 1965. So what that is it's basically the law. It's the federal government's role in higher education. So it covers a large swath of issues that we deal with, everything from federal financial aid to regulations and campus sexual assault, to a federal role with students and disabilities, to minority-serving institutions. It covers a large area of what our institutions deal with regarding the federal government and higher education. When we talk about something like the PROSPER Act, what that would do is it does not fully replace the underlying law. It makes modifications within the existing law. So when we last reauthorized the Higher Education Act in 2008, it made some modifications to the underlying law, and that's what we're looking at doing again. Oftentimes, Congress focuses a lot on Title IV, which is federal financial aid, and I think going into this reauthorization, that's again an area where you're going to see the most changes that we're going to talk about today.
Community colleges are open access institutions serving a diverse student population, including many students from low-income and underserved communities. Does the PROSPER Act affect access by these communities to higher education?
So fundamentally, it's not going to impact that our institutions are open access institutions. Students are still going to qualify to enter institutions in the same manner. There's no real federal role in that. That's institutional, local, state missions. But when you look at access as a whole, it goes beyond just your ability to apply to an institution and be accepted. One of the biggest roles with access, when you talk about the federal government, is federal financial aid, affordability, making sure students can get through the door and be able to access programs that may be financially out of reach. So when you look at the PROSPER Act and what it does in that area, there are both some good things and some bad things. You look at some expansions. For example, the Pell Grant program. It expands the Pell Grant program to include short-term training programs. So students who are, say, in a CDL program that's maybe 12 weeks long will now be able to access the Pell Grant program and Title IV aid in general, loans and so on. Also, it would open up Pell further for some students in competency-based education programs. It would reinstate eligibility for students in ability to benefit programs. However, on the flip side of that, it also pulls back on some current benefits that students receive. For example, supplemental educational opportunity grants. These are grants that go to students. It's known as campus-based aid. A lot of our students receive a couple $100s under this, so it's not a great amount of money, but it is additional grant funds. These would be eliminated under the bill. So I would say overall there's not any significant new investment in federal financial aid. So it's not necessarily increasing access significantly, but I wouldn't say that it is pulling back on it either.
We recently secured the ability for students to take advantage of Pell Grants during the summer term. Now, can our institutions expect to see any changes to that with the reauthorization, or is that safe?
So right now, that's pretty safe. One thing that we were worried about last year, whenever we were talking about reinstating summer Pell, was the idea that there might be some type of acceleration clause in there. And what this means is that students would have to be completing a certain amount of coursework rather than maybe attempting it. There would have to be more credits that had been checked off than perhaps is currently under law. A number of our students sometimes attempt courses but don't complete them for whatever reason. They still have to make satisfactory academic progress to maintain their eligibility for the Pell Grant program. But we want to make sure that students who perhaps took 12 credits one semester and 9 credits another semester weren't necessarily cut off from receiving summer Pell Grants. So there's some concern that perhaps, while it's not in the PROSPER Act, but going forward in the HEA reauthorization, that they might be looking to do something to put more requirements on students to receive the summer Pell Grant.
And as of now, the funding hasn't changed. Students still have the same access to the same amount of money. They can just take advantage of it in an additional term.
Correct. And I would say one thing that we would really like to see in the reauthorization of a Higher Education Act is the increase of the maximum Pell Grant award. Several years ago, Congress put mandatory money into the Pell Grant program. They did this when they eliminated the FFELP loan program and moved to the direct loan program. It generated a lot of savings for the federal government. So those savings were then utilized to expand the Pell Grant program. And over the years, there was an increase to the maximum award based on inflation each year. So generally, you would see a $100 increase, maybe a $120 increase. This is the first year now where that number has stagnated. We are at $5,920 unless Congress puts more money into the program. So ultimately, we would like to see another infusion of cash into the Pell Grant program so that we can continue those inflationary increases over the years. We don't want to see the buying power of the Pell Grant program diminish by not doing this. Certainly, we know that college costs go up, but also cost of attendance as a whole. You know, Pell Grant is out there to cover not just tuition and fees, but there's a refundable portion to go towards housing, transportation, food, childcare. All of these things go up with inflation year to year, and we want to make sure that the program can keep up.
And while summer Pell was secured in 2017, is 2018 the first summer that students will be able to take advantage of Pell funding in that term?
That's a rather technical question, Jacob. Ji Heng is over here rolling his eyes. But
she literally has a form about eligibility.
I have charts. So the easy answer to this is, for the vast majority of students, this will be the first summer that they can take advantage of the program.
Okay.
Yeah. While we're talking about Pell Grants, can I also ask, I know there was talk a while back of the surplus either being used for other things or if they were going to leave it alone. What's happening with that extra money?
I'll answer that in a second, but I know Ji Heng had something he wanted to add real quick.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up with something what Jennifer said about the Pell Grant and the Pell Grant maximum and the acceleration issue. One of our large concerns going forward as a community college sector is the concept of whether full-time for our students in general in higher education would constitute 15 credits. Right now, 12 credit hours is basically what constitutes full-time. And the question that some policymakers are advancing is the idea of forcing students to take 15 credit hours to essentially, that would be the new full-time. And for those of you who have seen our Financial Aid 102 document, you can see how some of our Pell Grant allocations are divided The Pell Grants is essentially into quartiles. So you have 25%, 50%, 75%, and 100%. And any type of increase in credit hours ultimately would probably reduce some of our grant awards for our students.
Now, would a change from 12 to 15 constituting full-time be exclusive to community colleges, or is that a change that would affect both four-year and two-year institutions?
It would affect all institutions.
Okay.
And all students.
Yeah, and keep in mind there's a state aid aspect to this as well. Sure. So students not only receive federal aid, they receive state aid as well. So this would basically be forcing the hands of states to perhaps match that 15 credit hour requirement. And, you know, quite frankly, not all programs fit neatly into that 15 credit hours per semester. You know, it would require a lot of our institution programs to totally redesign the way that they put their coursework forward. So we have a lot of concerns with this. And I will note that the PROSPER Act, which we talked about, they do institute a Pell Grant bonus. And this would be $300 additional dollars for students who took 15 credits, both in a fall and a spring semester. Indications were that they were heavily leaning towards making 15 the requirement for full time, and this was a bit of a compromise on their part not to get so much pushback. So keep in mind, this is something in the bill. Certainly it would expand for a lot of students a little additional aid. So it's just something to keep in mind as we move forward with the reauthorization.
So with students who are enrolled in apprenticeship programs who are spending maybe 50% of their time on the job, they might be out of luck if they're receiving Pell Grant funding, because especially if that time they're spent as an apprentice is not counted as a credit hour.
So potentially, yes. I mean, I think you would look at colleges would be redesigning their programs in order to make it so that they qualify for the maximum. However, that is costly for institutions. It doesn't neatly fit in a box, per se. And that also indicates that apprenticeship program was lengthy enough for that student to qualify for Pell as well.
There's been talk of the Pell Grant surplus being used for other things other than higher education. Does the PROSPER Act address any of those concerns?
So, no, it doesn't directly address the Pell Grant surplus. Within the bill, there's a number of things that generate savings and there's a number of things that generate costs. So, you know, certainly you might see in some fashion that they are utilizing the surplus, but we can't necessarily track that based on the way the spending is in the bill. I think you're more likely to see movement in the Pell Grant surplus via the appropriations process, and that's the annual spending bills that Congress passes. For example, when we got year-round Pell back into place, that was done via the appropriations process, and they used the Pell Grant surplus to make that happen.
There's been a lot of talk lately about simplifying the federal student loan program. What do community college leaders need to know about how the bill addresses the complexity of these programs?
One of the things that the PROSPER Act does is actually reduce the number of loan programs that we actually have in the federal government. The bill proposes to create one loan program. It's called the One Loan Program. And that means right now we have subsidized loans for undergraduates. We have unsubsidized loans for undergraduates. We have a Perkins Loans is gone, actually. We have a Plus Loan Program for Grad Plus. We have a Parent Plus Loan Program. And so all these programs would become one. The major thing for presidents and trustees to understand is that one of the major changes it does get rid of subsidized loans. So those low-income students who get a Pell Grant, who also get a loan, while you're in school, you're accruing interest. And that's a significant issue for these students. Furthermore, the proposal also reduces the number of income-based repayment programs to one and keeps standard repayment in place. So instead of having a myriad of loan repayment programs, you would ultimately only have two. And of those two, standard is 10 years, and the income-based repayment plan is forever as long as you go until you actually pay off your debt. There is no loan forgiveness as a component to the new loan repayment program.
Now, does the repayment option that a student is placed into automatically change?
So a student automatically goes into standard 10-year repayment unless they choose another plan. However, under the PROSPER Act, if they did go into default, their secretarial authority to then place that student into an income-based repayment plan. And I will note, different from what is current under the repayment plan as well, is currently you can owe zero per month if your income is low enough. The new minimum under this repayment plan would be $25. So there would be a monthly payment minimum of that going forward.
Would that secretarial authority in effect mean that students are automatically placed, or is there still an action they would have to take?
There would probably be thousands of pages of regulations written about what that means and how the secretary could make use of that. So it would be to be determined. The bill certainly doesn't go into enough detail to really fully flesh that out.
Okay.
There have been a number of proposals, like for an example, if you go 6 months into default, that you're automatically switched by your servicer into an IBR. The problem with, you know, moving a student into IBR is when you are paying, let's say, for an example, a student loan, the servicer does not necessarily know what your income is. There is no interconnection unless you actually do the forms to initiate an IBR plan. And so that's the one caveat as part of this, is how does a servicer transition an individual who's been paying standard each month or failing to pay standard, and then migrate them over. Obviously, one solution is to initiate the lowest dollar amount available to that individual as a start for their IBR payments. But I guess in the grand scheme of things, this is a functional way to help a student to try to fix their debt and their current situation and the repayment plan that they're in.
Which brings us to cohort default rates.
We have a cohort default rate that basically judges an institution's loan behavior of their students, and it is currently at an institutional level. So you'll see cohorts of 100 students, a couple tens of students, thousands of students in each cohort. We have a 3-year cohort default rate, so that measures a student who's entering repayment and follows them for a 3-year period of time and sees how they're doing on the repayment behavior. What the PROSPER Act is actually going to be doing is, instead of taking a look broadly at an institutional level, they would like to change it from a repayment to a repayment type, but also, or repayment measurement, but also just look at it at a programmatic level. So they would like to know, at an institution, our associate's degree in science and of nursing, what is the loan repayment rate for that individual program? So to try to get at a more granular level for these students on the behavior of your peers within your programmatic area, as opposed to taking a broader look at just X community college, it would actually be that program that you're in and looking at the loan repayment rate.
And as I say, it's interesting. The Department of Education's Inspector General just put out a report regarding the PROSPER Act, and this is one of the areas they identified as potentially problematic for the department. If you think about it, you have about 6,100 institutions. Each institution has probably anywhere between 10 and maybe 100 or so programs. So you would be collecting data on all of those programs relative to the repayment rate, which is something that would be new for the department in general. The department isn't like super great at doing that type of thing. So the idea that we would have potentially millions of units of this type of record that they would have to sort through and determine who's passing and who's not could be difficult for the department to actually implement.
And furthermore, if you think about it contextually for community colleges, we have a very low borrowing rate, and actually our borrowing rate since 2012 has actually declined. We are at 17%. In 2012, it is now 13% in 2017. And so with that decline, the way that we have measured cohort default rate, we have this thing called a participation rate index, and it's especially important for community colleges. And that basically says that community colleges, since they have such a low borrowing rate, there needs to be a mechanism in place that protects a community college based upon a small number of borrowers and defaulters impacting the eligibility of a community college's access to Title IV eligibility. So now take a look. You basically, if you go from the institutional level, let's say there's 100 borrowers and let's say 30 defaulted, you have a 30% default rate. But of that 100, if you go even more granular to the actual programmatic level, that's where you see further issues relative to us and our eligibility, because some of these programs will have 10 students, 5 students, 8 students, and we have broad concerns. And while there is a participation rate index at the loan repayment level, also for each of these programs, it becomes a bureaucratic issue for community colleges, because this is a participation rate index repeals are things that institutions have to do to get clearance from the Department of Education. So instead of maybe doing one for your institution, now you're going to be doing 10s, 20s of these type of applications to the Department of Education. So we're creating more regulatory burden for our colleges as part of this program.
More work too. It sounds expensive in the long run.
I mean, you know, certainly for institutions that don't have a whole lot of staff to do this type of thing, this is something to really keep in mind, that you would now need to be providing all this data to the federal government.
And in most cases, these schools aren't already keeping track of this data.
They are. So the way that all the colleges are keeping this data, but basically what you have to do is recreate a report that the federal government already technically has. And then if you think about it, instead of doing one institution-wide report for participation rate and index appeals, you would have to do it for all your various programs. And so if you had 5, then you have to do 5 different appeals for those individual programs, as opposed to just doing one at the institution-wide.
You know, and I think there's a big question, too. I mean, you would have to fail a 45% repayment rate for 3 years to be knocked out of the program. But what happens if your general studies program doesn't meet that? What happens if your English program doesn't meet that? Does the college now no longer offer an English major? I mean, I think there's some fundamental questions about what is the value in doing this? And does it really measure the quality of a program per se?
As far as the loan programs, because I feel like that's really important, what is it that trustees and community college leaders should be going to their representatives saying about this? Do we want to get rid of subsidized loans? Are we okay with that? Are we okay with just one income-based repayment program? No public loan forgiveness. Cohort default rates have never been perfect. So what is it? What should trustees be saying to their representatives about this part of the PROSPER Act?
So we have a myriad of priorities within HCA around the loan program. You can visit our advocacy website, now.acct.org, and also our advocacy section of our site to take a look at our legislative priorities under our resources section. What we can say is like a couple of things. Number one, we support subsidized loans. It's an important aspect for low-income students, the ability for the federal government to defray some of the interest that is accruing for these students is very important. What trustees and presidents should be doing as part of their conversation with the members of Congress is that, number one, while CDRs and loan repayment rates are a measurement, it is not by far the most important measurement for community colleges when you have a 12% borrowing rate. Additionally, there is some element of this is that we need the federal government to step up to the plate, especially around the servicing of these loans. Servicers are important. Servicers have a role. And while students are ultimately responsible for paying off their debt, we do need students to connect to their servicer, communicate with their servicer to pay off the debt. The other thing we would say is, like, you know, programs like PSLF are important programs. They'll help our teachers, they help our faculty members, they help a myriad of individuals pay off their debt and have some type of forgiveness at the end. I would say we're not enamored with having so many income-based repayment plans. We think that, you know, the current structure, there's too many. And having programs that where you have, for an example, like Repay, if you have graduate debt and undergrad debt, you have a 25-year repayment plan, and then there's forgiveness at the end. That seems like a really long time to be in repayment to get some type of forgiveness. But I think when students call their servicer and start talking about the various plans available to them, you can't have a functional conversation with your servicer because you're probably spending 2 or 3 minutes on each plan. And if you're talking 2 or 3 minutes on each plan and you get to plan 9, right, you've spent half an hour, and you're probably, if you haven't taken notes, you're probably going to pick the easiest plan to understand, which is standard repayment, which is probably not the best plan.
Now, who are these servicers?
They are a number of servicers. I believe there is 9 servicers in place right now. There are 4 main servicers, and then we have some not-for-profit servicers that also service our federal student loans. And they are managed by Federal Student Aid, which is a division of the Department of Education.
And what is their role as a go-between for students and the Department of Education?
So the way that it kind of functions is that once you initiate a loan, you're given information on who your servicer is, and that servicer follows you for a while until you leave college or graduate, and then they start the round of communication with you to ensure that you have initiated the process to start paying off your student loans.
And that discussion is something that happens for every student with every servicer.
Well, if they can find you.
If they can find you, correct.
So, I mean, certainly that's a problem with our student population, though, is that, emails become out of date, cell phone numbers become out of date, and before a student knows it, they're in default and they've never actually been contacted because they couldn't be. So, you know, that's something going into reauthorization that we would like to see, you know, make sure that that type of information is updated on a yearly basis for students that are taking out loans. Because it's not only good for the college, but it's good for the student as well, because defaulting is a big deal. I mean, it affects your credit. If you don't go out of default, it affects your ability to take out the future student aid. So, you know, it's certainly from all ends something we want to prevent.
Yeah, one of the things that institutions can actually do to help help servicers in this regard is actually to gather non-institutional emails. So like your Gmail, your Hotmail, I guess your old AOL, any other type of email that is not your institutional one, because many individuals no longer use their educational email after a period of time. And so at least this way they can try to track you down to help you start the conversation about repayment.
So the first contact a servicer has with a student who's taken out a loan isn't until after they finish school?
Technically, I believe the first contact is typically when you get your first loan. And when you get a loan, they'll initiate the process of, and you'll get a communication saying, we are your servicer for your loan. So we are here for you. And then basically, if the problem becomes, there is, I believe, a lag time between your first contact and when you actually go into grace, when you leave an institution. That's when you could have a year or a year and a half gap before that communication begins.
The bill includes language about institutional risk sharing, the idea that colleges would share additional financial liability tied to federal financial aid. How would this work?
Oh, I'm going to get this one.
you can start the first one.
So risk sharing has started out as kind of this concept that institutions should be more responsible for federal aid dollars that are given out to students. So what it is they call it skin in the game. That if a student doesn't pay back their loans, in this case with the Prosper Act, if a student doesn't complete their coursework, then the institution is going to have some type of additional financial liability or penalty. Up until the Prosper Act, we largely saw this as proposals whereby if you had, say, $1 million worth of loans that students did not repay, that the institution would be penalized for paying back a percentage of that. The Prosper Act kind of took that and made it way more complicated. They utilized something called return to Title IV funds. And what this is it's already in place. If a student is enrolled and receives a federal financial aid, both PAL and a loan, and does not complete their coursework for a semester, the institution is responsible and the student's responsible for paying back a portion of that. So what this would do is it would shift 90% of that responsibility for repaying those funds onto the institution, and it would create new tiers of penalties. So previously, or currently, if a student completes 60% of their coursework, at that point they are able to keep 100% of aid. Under this bill, a student could drop out at the 99% mark right before they took the final, and the institution would be responsible for returning 25% of federal student aid dollars. So in practical terms, we've reached out to a lot of our members at National Legislative Summit. We reached out to folks and asked them and their financial aid offices to figure out what the practical implication of this would be regarding finances in the institutions. And in most cases, we're seeing that the institution would owe back 2 to 3 times what is currently owed under return to Title IV. So in many cases, it could go from $2 million a year up to $6 million. So messaging-wise, it becomes difficult to kind of talk about this on Capitol Hill. You know, I think from a member perspective, we want them to educate their members of Congress, let them know what this is, let them know what the financial impact is, and that if this goes into place, a lot of our institutions are going to have to look at where do we make up this money. You know, do we cut services? Do we have to increase tuition? Compared to a proprietary institution, they can just say, okay, we're going to bake this into our financial model. You know, we're going to say, okay, we're going to charge a student X amount, figuring that we're going to have to pay back a certain percentage each year. Our institutions don't have that ability to do that type of thing. So we're concerned where the money is going to come from, what the impact will be on institutions, and also the fact that we don't control risk in a number one of these categories. So I don't know. Jihang maybe wants to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, just to follow up with something Jennifer said, it kind of shows you how this model will hurt our institutions. While she noted that someone at 99% would, who left our institution maybe the day before the final exam, and that the institution would have to return 25%, think of it in the context of a student who has entered classes for, let's say, a month, 3 weeks to a month, then they didn't reach a 25% threshold. That means the institution has to return 100% of the aid back to the federal government. That's a big issue. Obviously, for our institutions, we have, number one, the student has been working with our registrar's office to get registered. They've been working through the course catalog. They have probably worked with our financial aid office to secure a Pell Grant and a loan, or possibly a loan. They've also probably worked with our advisors to try to figure out, they've interfaced with our faculty members. And to say that a student, you know, who has been in courses and have been on our campuses for multiple weeks, that the college has returned 100% of all Title IV aid, seems like a heavy push for us, because that essentially means, you know, all of our efforts for the lead time of helping this person secure financial aid, to getting them enrolled, to actually doing courses or instructing and instruction and teaching, none of that matters, you have to return 100%, seems like a very heavy penalty to face for our institutions. And it becomes a broader issue as open access institutions, how we deal with that type of risk. And, you know, for public institutions like ours, it becomes a big issue in that the concept of risk sharing has always been that institutions can't adjust their risk. And the ways that institutions can adjust their risk has been selectivity and decreasing their cost of tuition and fees to essentially say, especially on the loan side of risk sharing, is to say, if we increase selectivity and we lower the costs, then number one, your students should be possibly doing better. And number two, by decreasing your tuition and fees, that means that students have to borrow less. The reality of in this conversation is that, for example, in our California community college system, 50% of our students pay no tuition and fees. So, but we have individuals in the California system who are defaulting at high levels. They're defaulting on very low debt, but they're still defaulting, and institutions would be responsible for those type of students. So we have significant concerns with, broadly speaking, any type of risk sharing model and skin in the game, because we are really in the skin of the game, because we are public institutions. We're supported by local and also state dollars.
Let's switch over to apprenticeships. There's been a lot of emphasis put on apprenticeships lately. Can we expect this bill to address apprenticeships and the role colleges will play in expanding them?
So the bill does create a new apprenticeship program. It does so basically by eliminating the current title for teacher education assistance. So it would be fairly large. It's $183 million a year is what it would be authorized at. You would be looking at grants that would either go out to institutions or businesses based on sort of an industry partnership with an institution of higher education. There would be a match requirement under the grant, and funds would be used for things like books and supplies, student wages, developing programming around the apprenticeship program. You know, I think overall we feel as though it's good that this area has been recognized within the PROSPER Act. We would like to see some tweaks to how this is proposed. Particularly around, you know, who's going to control the grant. We would like to see money be able to be devoted towards instruction. You know, the match requirement is a little high. So I think that even though we recognize that this is a good moving forward and we'd like to see an apprenticeship recognition in the final HEA bill, we would like to make some changes to what exists under the PROSPER Act.
So with all of this in mind, if there's one thing that a community college leader can do to advocate for their institution in regards to this bill, what do you think they should be doing?
So, you know, I would say that leading up to NLS, the one thing that we really wanted our folks to talk about was the risk-sharing proposal. A lot of our folks, when they see it, they say, oh, well, this couldn't ever happen. But the bottom line is it has bipartisan support in both the House and Senate. There are multiple proposals out there that do various things. So when you go in and meet with your member of Congress, a lot of them have never heard about this. They don't know what it is. It really sounds good, risk sharing, skin in the game. Oh, yeah, we should do that. So educating members of Congress regarding what this is and the actual impact on institutions is probably our top priority going into this.
And I think while that is our top priority as relative to the PROSPER Act, one of the things that we need everyone to do is get their member of Congress on their campus, have them meet with their faculty members, their administrators, and especially their students, so the students can talk a little bit about their experience, talk to them about their issues that they have that arise. And furthermore, talk to your members of Congress about the interconnection of federal aid and why our institutions are advocating for it. So talk to them about the Pell Grant program. Talk to them about the loan programs. Talk to them about the SEOG program. Talk to them about the work study program. Talk to them about, you know, whether or not you're a minority serving institution and receive grants under that. It's really important to the member to understand why we support these things. It's because there are students, there are programs that help our students, and that's why we, you know, as Jennifer mentioned, risk sharing is our top priority for the PROSPER Act and going forward on the reauthorization of HEA, but it's also about communicating and effectively advocating, and that's one of the ways we do that is talk to your members of Congress about the programs of importance.
And as Jihang already mentioned, we have resources available on our website, acct.org, for publications such as Financial Aid 102 and for advocacy resources at now.acct.org. Additionally, if you'd like, you can sign up for our latest Action in Washington e-alert network. And to join that, just email publicpolicy@acct.org with law alert in the subject of the email. India, Jihang, Jennifer, thank you for your time.